Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Thank you for joining me for another program of Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Baby Boomer Chris Stockley in this, the second of a four-part series. Last week we learned Chris was born in 1948 and grew up largely around the southern UK city of Winchester. Music became a passion for him at an early age, and with so much American rock, blues and R&B coming through the UK via the major seaports, his musical education was deep and thorough. Then just as the British music scene was exploding around him in the early 1960s, his parents and Chris came to Australia and settled in Melbourne. This week we learn more about Chris's response to having to leave the music-rich United Kingdom for what appeared to be a Melbourne music scene that was many years behind the United Kingdom. He meets and forms a friendship with a young Melbourne man, and together they form a duo, which in turn leads Chris to his first band, the Roadrunners. Chris's story takes us through the developing Melbourne music scene and how, and inevitably, he becomes involved with his first professional group, Campact, which then leads him to joining Axiom with the legendary Brian Cadd and Glenn Shorrock. We learn how the group at its peak of popularity went to the United Kingdom and flopped, and Chris candidly shares the reasons and stories behind this terrible moment. We pick up with Chris and I talking about the formation of many music venues in Melbourne. So not only were you really in those formative years in Melbourne of the development of bands playing electric blues and R&B and everything, you were also around then during those formative years when all the little clubs and music venues were starting to proliferate.
Yeah. That was an interesting time, though, because there was no licensed venues back then.
No.
So I think, I forget when 6 o'clock closing ended, but I know when I came out here it was still in force. And so there were no venues with bands playing.
Oh, God, no.
And it was like, I remember going to the dances, like a penthouse in Ormond, I think it was, and, you know, all these just little tiny town halls, you know, council buildings, and you'd have bands playing. No booze.
Oh, no.
Nothing like that. And they closed at, you know, 10 o'clock and that sort of thing. So there wasn't a lot of work, per se. Oh, I remember, John and I started doing a couple of duo things, and then we decided we were going to get electric and got, I think, I can't remember the very first players we used, but I know the first band ended up with Bob Lloyd on drums and Chris Kimmel on bass, and that was the Roadrunners.
The Roadrunners, yeah.
And, yeah, we used to get gigs at Tyson Q. I guess it was called Q Club.
Q Club, I think it was at that stage, yes.
And Penthouse and that sort of thing, but there really wasn't much around. As I said, it was all, you know, very young people.
It wasn't too long, though, then, before places like Birdies and Sebastian's and the Tum started to...
That's right. They started happening maybe a year or two after what I'm talking about here. But once again, they weren't licensed either.
Oh, no.
And it always fascinated me how everyone in the place was so whack and out of it. But I know, as a band, we used to take our little flasks of whiskey and mix them with Coke. Yeah, they were fun times. Actually, that's when music started to get really good. So because around that time is when you started getting the Max Merritts, and it was still one of the best bands I ever saw, particularly the original band that I saw with Peter Williams and Bruno and Billy Christian. I mean, every band Max had was great, but that first one just blew me away because there were only four of them, and they sounded like the Stax band. They sounded like they had horns.
Yes.
It was amazing.
Yes.
I loved that band. Which was a breakthrough because that was music I like. I think the first band I went to see in Australia, and this was kind of weird because everyone was trying to keep me happy because I was, you know, a bit down after leaving all my friends and the music band. And they took me to the Footscray-O-Rama and I saw, it was called 6040. I had no idea what that meant, but it meant it was very, very square indeed.
Oh, yes.
But the band was the Fendermen. And they all had matching suits and matching guitars and little steps, like the Shadows. Which we sort of got rid of that.
Yes,
we were all the Stones now. And they know it. There were no band uniforms, you know. And he had Jagger leaping over the stage and going nuts. And it was like, oh, my God, what have I come to?
Yes.
But by the time, yeah, when you're saying this era of Bertie Sebastians and that sort of thing, yeah, there was some really good bands starting to happen then. And, yeah, you know, we started to get a bit of competition too, but, you know. But previous to that, of course, the centre of gravity for bands or people interested in what we were doing was Chicago, which was a warehouse, and we met people of a similar mind and similar music then, and that was when the Melbourne R&B scene started.
It was really Melbourne's only true R&B blues club, wasn't it?
Oh, of course, yeah.
And the others were more pop-oriented.
Oh, well, they were pop, and like you had the diehard jazz and folkies,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
And it was kind of weird because in England people jumped on the R&B thing as the intellectual sort of music, long before they did in Australia. Australia still sort of looked at electric guitars and thought, you know, I'll be a folkie and listen to blues.
That's why I was intrigued when you were telling your story earlier about how you tracked back to the origins, right back to Robert Johnson at such an early age, whereas in Australia, during that period, we had absolutely no idea.
Mm.
Never heard of them.
Well, there were so many people in England who were onto it because it was the big thing, R&B. It was, you know, jazz was gone. And the thing, in England, the jazz clubs that were everywhere morphed into the R&B clubs, and they did it by way of the people like Alexis Corner and Cyril Davies, who were sort of like the jazzers let them play there because they were kind of jazz in a way. But I think electric guitars were still pretty much out of the picture until you started getting the original Rolling Stones and the people before them, Long John Baudry and the players he had. They were sort of into the jazz circuit, but they were injecting the R&B thing into it. And that kind of didn't really happen in Australia, I think. There was no one playing blues here, really. Whereas in England, people have been doing it for quite some time. I mean, because, you know, quite an influx of American music was always coming off the docks in Liverpool and Southampton, and, you know, people coming back from America with all this fantastic stuff, you know. I remember hearing, when I was still in England, would have been in the early 60s, 61, 62, hearing stuff like Ernie Cato's Mother-in-Law, which was way away from blues. And I thought, once again, I was like, what the hell is that? That is the greatest music I've heard, you know, and Sam Cooke and stuff like that. So I'm getting all the full of blues, and at the same time I'm hearing the current sort of stuff, like, you know, that, and I'm going, oh, this is just too much to take in.
Like,
you know,
a blotter, you're just soaking.
It was all around you then, yeah. Whereas in Australia, there was nothing like that. There was no history of blues here or anything like that, and you didn't have people coming off the docks with
arms full of albums, right.
You know.
Yes, no, we didn't.
Yeah, and so it was a bit different in that regard. You really had to make your own music. But, you know, like, that was my thing when I first got here, was I had to make my own fun. I wasn't going to be able to see anyone else play the music I liked. You know, so it was either buying records and then trying to do it myself.
Without wanting to shine your halo for you, you must have been fairly instrumental then into introducing a lot of Australian musicians to R&B and blues.
Yeah, totally.
Because
even a kid in England with Elvis and Little Richard and the rock and roll guys I started out listening to, I was always a real crusader. I mean, I couldn't believe that no one would ever not like this. You have to be crazy not to like this. Yeah, this is the best thing I've ever heard. You know, I would not leave people be, you know. And this, when I got out here, everyone I get, I must have been a pain in the ass. I didn't think so at the time. I just thought it was normal. But I mean, I was basically grabbing people by the throat and saying, listen to this, don't you get it? This is the greatest thing you've ever heard. And, you know, because some people got it and some people didn't. Like, hearing Howlin' Wolf for the first time, it's a bit of a hard thing to take for a lot of people,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, definitely.
And but of course, I was just so in awe of all that stuff. You know? Mm. But I did. I suppose I did. I mean, because as I said, John Pugh was one of the first guys I ever met up with, and he was very open to it, though. You know, he wasn't hard to convince, whereas some people didn't get it or took them a while to get it. But so yeah, I did. I take that to compliment.
Listen to Older Voices. Living History on Ageless Radio. This is a special Baby Boomers edition.
In addition to a great musical revolution happening not just in Australia but around the world, but in Melbourne in particular, there were a lot of social upheavals going on, nonetheless being the Vietnam War. Did you ever find yourself taking a political position at that period, or was music so ingrained you didn't take any notice?
I found when the Vietnam War and conscription was starting to happen, it became, the music then became inseparable from the political thing. And it, because you had the Stones, I mean, obviously we're jumping in time here, you had the Stones, you know, and street fighting men and things like that, and you had Hendrix and, you know, all that sort of thing happening, and the political thing you couldn't really separate from the music, I don't think, large part of it. And Lennon, of course, at that stage was becoming increasingly political as well. And I became, once again, we are jumping ahead, but I become really involved in being anti-Vietnam and anti-conscription. And then this led to me leaving home, a large contributing factor to me leaving home, because, as I said before, my grandparents and father were very much of everyone should be in the army, everyone should learn how to use a gun and conscription to make a man out of you and all that sort of thing. And I used to have, like, real bad arguments with my dad about it, because he had, I can't say this in a nice way, he really wasn't smart when it came to politics, you know. He was, like, believed in the capital punishment, but believed in conscription. If your country sent you to war, it was my country, right or wrong, whether it was England or Australia or whatever. And I used to have so many arguments. I said, you vote Labor, and yet here you are, all your politics are conservative. I said, you're an idiot, you know, and that didn't go down well. And I said, how can you do that? It doesn't make sense. And anyway, I used to have dreadful arguments, and eventually...
But I suspect that sort of division between sons and daughters and parents was going on all over the place in that period,
because
it was the generation gap really was so severe in the 60s between us.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, parents,
and that's exactly right. And that gave birth to the boomers, and, you know, it's radical, you know, and, like, the whole thing about the division between parents and children, and it was just huge, you know. That, I mean, I know from my experience, like, you know, all my friends were going through the same thing, huge fights with parents about it, because our parents grew up with that, believing you serve your country, right or wrong. And I was saying, no, serve your country if it's right, but not when it's painfully wrong, like this was, like the Vietnam War. And finally, people in this time are agreeing with it. You know, I was watching that current series on Vietnam recently. It was sensational. But I knew all that. I knew it. And part of that reason, my education in that regard came from some notorious people that I met through music, and through Chicago and through Bob Dylan and blues and stuff. I ended up leaving home and moving into a house with David Pepperell and John O'Brien and Bob Lloyd and these people. And it was very political, it was very poetic, and very anti-conscription, anti-Vietnam. So my politics were, like, once again, they were sewn in by that stage, and once again affected my life, and almost to the degree that music did, I suppose.
Now, music, as we've discovered, has played a really important part of your life from a very early age. When or at what band did it become what we might call really serious, that it suddenly exploded and got to the point where you became really known?
Well, that's, I suppose, the first any kind of success I had. The blues bands were never really successful. We never really recorded, made anything releasable. So the Roadrunners morphed into the Delta Set. The Delta Set morphed into Campact, which was already then getting into the soulier side of things. So we're sort of moving away from the blues a bit. And it was interesting because overseas the Stones were doing the same thing. They were doing, you know, Marvin Gaye and all that sort of stuff, and Sam Cooke, and we were getting into that vibe as well. And that's when we actually started making records for release. And Campact got a couple of records out. We had a couple of minor hits, one of which was I'm Your Puppet, which was a James and Bobby Purify. Well, their version is the one we pinched. And actually, it was quite a good record. I played it recently because, well, not recently, a couple of years ago, I did that launch for Dave Pepperell's book. And we had to do I'm Your Puppet, as we were featured in the book.
your puppet.
I thought, that's not bad, you know. It was because at the time you never think I never think anything I do is any good. But an occasion in retrospect, I changed my mind. And with that one, I did. I thought, that's a damn good record for a bunch of blokes who didn't really know what they were doing.
Turn you some lips, I'm your puppet.
That was a bit of a hit, and then we dribbled on. Eventually, it started to get a bit poppy for me, and I never was comfortable with it. And that's when I got the offer to join Axiom, which was then another life-changing.
That was a big band, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Big in terms of popularity.
Well, they came from two of the biggest bands in the country.
Which were?
The Twilights and The Group.
Right.
Who had mega hits. You know, we're talking platinum record type hits. And Dougie the drummer was from the Ballantines, who were sort of maybe a couple of levels down from that, but still very popular. So I joined up with those guys. And that was a shock, you know, because I was working on an entirely different level. Really, for the first time, serious songwriters. In the past, we pretty well relied upon covering songs, and we're just starting to dabble in writing, because that was when it became apparent that you had to start writing your own stuff. And of course, you just don't do that overnight unless you are a Lennon or a McCartney or someone. But when I joined Axiom, it was like, these guys had hit records with their own songs, and that was, whoa, you've got to come up with your own licks and your own riffs and parts. If you want to stay on this level, you've got to be...
Was that challenging for you?
Oh, yeah, it was really challenging. I mean, I loved the challenge, but, it wasn't all smooth sailing either. It was a real kick in the ass to be put on the spot like that. And as you know, with that band, we had about three pretty big singles and an album that got pretty wide acclaim. And then it was off to England.
Yes, and there it all sort of... fell apart a bit, didn't it?
Well, yeah, it was very exciting because we left Australia just about at the height of our popularity, which in one way is a good way to go. And Don and Brian and Glenn really, really couldn't wait to get back to England because they'd both been there with their respective groups, tried hard and failed, but they saw that, or they thought they saw that, you had to crack it in England to crack it in the world. But the world was changing. And now it's interesting because I've been playing with Glenn and Brian and whatever recently, and how, in retrospect, no, Axiom was very much influenced by the band. Had we had a wits about us, we would have gone to America, and it might have been a slower, harder road, but we would have probably done better in America than we did in England because I don't think England was that hip to the country-ish sort of thing. I remember the only kind of country band I saw when I was in England with Axiom was, I think, Matthew Southern Comfort. And they were really good. And they had probably the only pedal steel player in England at the time, BJ Cole, who was fantastic. Once again, never seen anyone play one of those before. But that was good. And, of course, there was a bloke called Albert Lee, who everyone said, you've got to see this guy Albert Lee, because he was playing James Burton and country stuff. But I never got to see him play in those days. But anyway, that's it. I digress. Yeah, anyway, we went to England. We did a few gigs, but not anything mainstream. Got a record deal, which was pretty incredible for the time. Got a record out, and it was getting played on Luxembourg. And things were looking okay, and then the band just folded. We'd been living in the one house, all of us, with our wives, and it just doesn't bode well. It was just... And for us, because we weren't on the road gigging, we were just... It was like almost like being in jail, you know, and we had very little money, so going out was like, you know, at a premium. And people used to get freebies. Why and our manager would get us into the speakeasy where I saw some of the best acts ever. You know, we'd get in there for nothing and all that. Then I also, at the same time, ran into members of Procol Harum via some mutual friends, and that was kind of interesting too. And I started, you know, when you start meeting people at that level, once again, it's a bit of an eye-opener.
Certainly, yes. Did it distress you that Axiom didn't fire?
Yeah, it was
at that level and at that time.
I think we'd come out of being really successful in Australia, and there's a certain pride you take in being sort of known and being successful. But over there, we were nothing, and we were broke pretty well, you know. And it was a bit, you know, demeaning. And, you know, I think everyone felt it. Everyone wanted to be earning money. For me, I really wanted to be gigging. But the other guy said, look, we've been over here and we did it the hard way, gigging, and it's pretty thankless because you get treated, you know, pretty badly, a bottom of the bill, not top of the bill, like we were in Australia. Yes. And you've got to, you know, we don't want to do that road again. Let's make till we get the record successful and then we'll go on the road. But for me, I mean, my lifeblood was playing and I just wanted to get out and do it. And I think with all those conflicting ideas, the band just started to crumble and we were driving each other nuts all living in the same house, you know. And it just fell apart. And I remember we had a big meeting with Warner Brothers and they were so pissed off because they'd spent all this money on, you know, the album promoting and all that sort of stuff. And then to find out they didn't have a band, it was just, they were not happy.
So you returned to Australia having left Axiom.
Well, what happened, we made the record in England and while it was being mixed and they were putting, you know, horns and strings and a bit of, you know, fairy dust on it, we came back and did a quick tour around Australia, get some money and have some fun and be playing. And that was great. It was quite successful. Went back to England and basically that was over. You know. And another reason was we weren't happy with the English album we made. We had Shel Tamy, so-called, producing it. And he was a huge producer, having done Who, The Kinks, you know, I mean, I think maybe Small Faces, and he had a really, really great reputation, especially for pop rock, which is kind of where we were sitting. And basically he didn't do anything at all. And he just said yes or no to whatever we were doing in the studio. And it was kind of weird. Anyway, we got back and the horns that they'd put on in our absence and the mixes were just bloody awful. You know, it was just dreadful. And we were pretty upset about that. And I think that was another blow that caused us to basically split. And then what happened? There we were in England with no money in South London. Glenn was, I think he got offered some kind of a solo thing. So he was going to stay and he was all right. Don Moody wasn't well. He wanted to get back to Australia as soon as he could. Brian was already looking for other alternatives and it kind of left some of us just...
Hanging loose?
Hanging. We had no money to get home and nothing. And I was married to Robin at the time and she was very pregnant. And things weren't looking good at all. But I could have stayed, but I didn't have really any kind of network. My network musically was back in Australia, and I really didn't have any choice but to come back. I could have maybe stuck it out, but it would have meant getting a day gig and maybe just missing out completely. I think, figured if I went back to Australia, at least some people know who I am, because nobody knew I was in England, really.
Yeah.
And so Don put together, like, the remains of the Axiom, plus two of the guys from the Mixtures had just been asked to leave the Mixtures because the original guys wanted back in, because the Pushbike song had gone number one in England, and they quit before it happened, and boy, did they want their job back. Mm. So I thought it was a bloody dreadful move, but Mick and Greg Cook, who I'd known for many years, decided, well, they had no choice. They were booted out of the Mixtures, and they were a loose end. It was kind of fortunate for us, so we had a band we could put together.
In next week's program, Chris talks at some length about his role in and the formation of one of Australia's most iconic groups, the Dingoes. This is a program not to be missed. That's Chris Stockley on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Turak Times.